Chapter 7. A Revolution Unnoticed. Diets that reduce excess fat without hunger require that insulin be minimized. Why the magic? What does this experience of weight loss free from obsessive hunger tell us about the makeup of diets that can make this happen? And perhaps more important, about the relationship between what we eat and why we get fat to begin with. In other words, is it what we eat or how much we eat that's the problem? Between the mid-1950s and 1970, the answers to these questions were mostly worked out by laboratory researchers studying fat metabolism. They made the critical advances post-1960, following the invention of a laboratory technique, an assay, that allowed these researchers, for the first time ever, to accurately measure the levels of hormones circulating in the bloodstream. The inventors were the physicist Roslyn Yalow and the physician-researcher Solomon Burson. Yalow won the Nobel Prize for the work in 1977. Burson died in 1972 and so could not share it. The Nobel Committee described Yalow and Burson's assay as bringing about a revolution in biological and medical research. It did, but the revolution passed mostly unnoticed by the obesity research community and by those authorities who were advising us on what we must do to achieve and maintain a healthy weight. Not so the fad diet book doctors of the era, but the same authorities were telling us in no uncertain terms that the diet book doctors were quacks. The revelations from this half-century-old research are more important than the latest studies covered in the media that purport to tell us the constituents of healthy eating, and I'll tell you why. Remember, we're dealing with a disorder of excess fat accumulation, as Brooke and Astwood said. And so we need to understand the physiological processes that regulate fat metabolism in the human body. In particular, borrowing Astwood's phrase, the complex role the endocrine system plays in the regulation of fat. This then raises the mechanism questions. We know this system is shifted in the direction of storage, and indeed excess storage, but what could explain that shift? And how does this shift in the direction of storage relate to what we eat or how much we eat, such that we can influence it or ideally reverse it by diet? The endocrine system does indeed play a complex role in all this, but the answers that are required to successfully treat overweight and obesity by dietary changes turn out to be relatively simple, with the acknowledgement that relative is a relative term. By the 1950s, researchers studying human metabolism, most notably the Nobel laureate Hans Krebs, for whom the famous Krebs cycle by which our cells are energized is named, had already come to understand the basic metabolic systems that work to ensure that the food we eat is made available as a steady and reliable flow of energy to all the cells in our body. The gist of it is that the power plants in the cells, known as mitochondria, that generate the energy we use for life, can do so by burning carbohydrates, proteins, or fats as fuel, the three macronutrients in our diet. The endocrine system, hormones and their target enzymes, then plays the critical role in orchestrating what we do with these fuels, when we do it, and for how long. By 1962, when Astwood gave his presidential address to the Endocrine Society, endocrinologists knew that most of the hormones they had identified work to accelerate the release of fat from our fat cells so that cells in the muscles and organs can use it for fuel. These hormones work to make us thinner, in effect, because they work to make our individual fat cells thinner. Hormones are signaling our bodies to do something, fight, flee, grow, reproduce. It makes sense from an engineering perspective alone that they would also make available the fuel necessary for that action to take place. They liberate fat from our fat cells and prepare the other cells in our bodies to burn that fat for fuel. When you're scared, for instance, your adrenal glands respond by secreting adrenaline into your circulation. That adrenaline not only revs you up to fight or flee, it causes your fat cells to liberate stored fatty acids so that fat is available in the circulation to fuel any fighting or fleeing that might take place. As adrenaline and these hormones linger in the circulation, they keep these fatty acids available just in case. While they do so, they deter the fat cells from taking up fat and storing it. From the perspective of the fat cell, they keep it leaner than it would otherwise be. The reverse process, the reincorporation of fat into the depots, as Astwood called it, was found to be dominated by a single hormone. All the other known hormones worked against putting fat into fat cells or back into fat cells. The hormone insulin, as Astwood said, strongly promoted it. While physicians and diabetes specialists, even endocrinologists, had come to think about insulin almost exclusively as a hormone that controls blood sugar, most still do, that's like thinking of the conductor of an orchestra as conducting only a single instrument. Insulin does many things in the human body. A primary function is indeed to keep blood sugar under control. But the relevant point for our purposes is that one way it accomplishes that is by also promoting the storage of fat. Prior to the discovery of insulin in 1921, patients with what we now call type 1 diabetes, the acute form of the disease that typically appears in childhood, would die emaciated and famished, no matter how much food they consumed. But administering insulin to these young patients would bring them back from the brink of death and have them looking healthy again within weeks. It was life-saving. It also appeared, quite obviously, to be fattening, albeit in a good way. Charles Best, who discovered insulin with his fellow Canadian Frederick Banting, later co-authored a medical textbook that declared this an unmistakable observation. The fact that insulin increases the formation of fat has been obvious ever since the first emaciated dog or diabetic patient demonstrated a fine pad of adipose tissue made as a result of treatment with the hormone. For those who needed more evidence, insulin therapy was also used in the 1920s to fatten up underweight and emaciated patients, those who today we would say suffer from anorexia. It was also used through the mid-20th century as a kind of shock therapy in mental hospitals for patients with schizophrenia. These patients typically responded to the therapy by getting fatter. Most famously, the Princeton mathematician and future Nobel laureate John Nash and the author and poet Sylvia Plath. In her fictionalized account of her experience, Plath wrote that she put on 20 pounds with insulin therapy, that she just grew fatter and fatter. When insulin was administered to patients with the chronic form of diabetes, what used to be called adult onset diabetes and is now known as type 2 diabetes, they also got fatter. They still do. While these insights were not embraced by researchers thinking about obesity, their reason was understandable. Yes, insulin clearly seemed to make people fatter in these specific situations. But many or most people diagnosed with diabetes, those with type 2, were already overweight or obese even before insulin therapy. Until the early 1960s and the work of Yallo and Bearson, the consensus of opinion among physicians and diabetes specialists was that all cases of diabetes had a deficiency of insulin, too little insulin to control blood sugar. This was clearly the case for the acute childhood form, type 1. So these physicians and researchers assumed it was true for all diabetics. If individuals with diabetes could be obese even if they lacked insulin necessary to keep their blood sugar in check, it was hard to imagine how insulin played any significant role in having made them, or anyone else, fat. This is where being able to actually measure hormone levels in the bloodstream made all the difference. Beginning in 1960, in their very first papers using their new insulin assay, Yallo and Bearson reported that people who were obese, and particularly those who were both obese and diabetic, had excessive amounts of insulin circulating in their blood. Not too little, too much. Older patients with obesity and diabetes weren't suffering from insulin deficiency. Rather, they seemed to be resistant to the insulin they were secreting. This condition is now known as insulin resistance. Insulin resistance turns out to be fundamental to both obesity and type 2 diabetes, Type 2 diabetes more or less is insulin resistance, and all the chronic diseases associated with them. When we are insulin resistant, our bodies, the pancreas specifically, produce more and more insulin trying to achieve the necessary blood sugar control. As this happens, as Yalow and Berson suggested, that insulin will do what insulin does, which is signal fat cells to store fat. The fact that people with obesity and type 2 diabetes are fat is evidence of that. The cells of lean tissue and organs, specifically the liver, might be insulin resistant, even while fat cells remain sensitive to the hormone. By 1965, Yalow and Berson were describing insulin as the principal regulator of fat metabolism, and suggesting that the insulin resistance that they were seeing in people with obesity and diabetes might clearly explain why they were fat. When insulin is secreted, it prompts cells throughout the body to take up more blood sugar from the circulation and use it for fuel. It causes liver cells to make fat from glucose and ship that fat out for storage, and it induces fat cells to take up and store any fat for the future. To get fat out of those fat cells, as Yalow and Berson described it, the absolute fundamental requirement was not eating less or exercising more, but lowering the amount of insulin in the circulation. Eating less and exercising, as I'll discuss, can be inefficient ways of lowering insulin levels. To be precise, Yalow and Berson said, getting fat out of our fat cells requires only the negative stimulus of insulin deficiency. That concept is fundamental to understand. University of Wisconsin researchers studying obesity made a similar declaration in the prestigious Journal of the American Medical Association. It could be stated categorically, they wrote in 1963, that obesity was impossible without adequate levels of insulin, and that storing excess fat cannot take place without some insulin around to make it happen, and critically, without the body taking in carbohydrates, glucose, to stimulate that insulin secretion. In short, by 1965, there were now two competing ideas about how foods and diets can affect our weight and how much fat we store. The conventional wisdom was then, and remains still, going back to how the textbook of obesity phrased it in 2012, that all diets that result in weight loss do so on one basis and one basis only: they reduce total calorie intake. The alternative, the one that's based on biology rather than supposedly physics, is all diets that result in weight loss do so on one basis and one basis only. They reduce circulating levels of insulin. They create and prolong the negative stimulus of insulin deficiency. I know the math, Roxane Gay says in her memoir, Hunger, as though that should be enough to solve her unruly body and reduce her excess fat. In order to lose a pound of fat, you must burn 3,500 calories. She then goes on to observe that this knowledge has clearly been useless to her. What I and others are suggesting is that knowing the math is irrelevant. What's necessary to prevent and treat and maybe even reverse obesity is knowing the endocrinology, the hormonal influences, and how those in turn can be influenced by what we eat.